Radio.
You're listening to The Community Show on 10 Radio with Anton and Pauline today, and now we're very pleased to welcome two guests into the studio, one of whom is brand new to 10 Radio, but John Doble, good morning and welcome back to 10 Radio. Good morning.
Good morning, Pauline.
And it's wonderful because you're going to introduce your friend who's with us this morning, Sibusiso Vilani, to 10 Radio. Sibusiso was the first black African to climb Mount Everest, and 2 years later he did it again. So we're going to talk to Sibusiso about his journey through life to the point of climbing Everest and very much beyond. But first, John, your background is in the diplomatic service over many years. And what I'd like to ask you is how you two met and where and how your friendship and then almost professional friendship developed. Where did you meet?
Well, first of all, Sibusiso is the first black person in the world to climb Mount Everest, not just the first black African. I was posted to Swaziland in February 1996, and I'd been in the country about 2 or 3 days, and I was going to be there 3 or 4 years. And I thought, what am I going to do in this tiny little place about the size of Wales, but a very beautiful country, very mountainous, and every weekend? And I looked at the map, and there was a nature reserve, magnificent Malolotja Nature Reserve in the mountains. So I went walking there, and I walked to the top of the highest waterfall in southern Africa, in fact, and came back to the entrance. And it was a misty day, and it's very steep and rugged, the terrain there. And I said to the ranger on duty, that was fantastic, but it's a bit dodgy walking alone. One could get lost or fall over
in the
a precipice.
Mist and so on, yes.
And I said, do you have groups walking? And the ranger said, no. He said, the Natural History Society come once a year, but no, we don't have groups. You've just got to walk with your friends. And I hadn't got any friends in Swaziland. Mm. I knew nobody. And going off duty, it was another ranger sitting in the corner of the room, sorting out his kit, and this was Sibusiso. He didn't know from Adam who I was, and he said, I'm not walking next Saturday. I'll take you into the mountains. He didn't say, like people in the Western world would say, I charge £10 an hour, or this will be £100 for the day.
So
he gave up, and he had a wife and 2 children already. Yeah. He gave up his only day off to take a total stranger. He didn't know from Adam who I was. Mm. For a day into the mountains, and that led to everything.
A lifelong friendship.
Yeah.
How lovely. And John, you have climbed and explored all of your life, and you continue to do so, and so that was your passion. But
well, this I get from him, you see. He has done so much for me, because I was encouraging him with his climbing. I thought this is such a fantastic sport, so I took it up myself at the age of 61. So I've got so much from him.
So actually, before that, you hadn't been particularly active in climbing and
I had always been in walking in the mountains. I went to the top of Mount Fuji at the age of 21, which you just walk up there. But no climbing.
No. So that's how your friendship began. So you spent this day together, both enjoying the mountains, and Sibusiso, you knew the mountains very well, and climbing was no difficulty because you are very slight as well, so you could just fly up to the top. What happened after that? What then was the next step to the next part of your life?
Well, then it was the beginning of really all bigger things that have happened. But the way it happened was that on the day that I was walking with John, I was acting guide or leader, and I was walking in the front and telling him where to be careful, and we were crisscrossing a river, and all the time me suggesting to him that, no, don't place your foot there, place your hand over here. And then we finally got to a wonderful part of the river, which had a wonderful waterfall. And we came from the bottom of the waterfall, but it looked quite pretty if someone would just be above the waterfall and have a view of it from the top. And John somehow wanted us to try and climb up to the top part of the waterfall, which obviously I said it was possible, provided we didn't swim, because I couldn't swim at the time. And we did scramble with ease and with such agility. We got to the top, and then I led him down again. And as we were about to hit the trail, then John suddenly said to me, "Sibusiso, so you climb with this amazing ease and agility, and you don't show any fear. For me, you do portray this amazing talent to climb. I think you could make a good climber." Then he went on to say, "But it sort of puzzles me that there are not many climbers coming from the African continent." And obviously I had to say my own thing, where I tried to talk him off the idea of him selling climbing to me. I said, "Well, the people that come and sign up here in the game reserve, and they always disappear for a number of days going on a big hike. And I always look at their facial expression when they walk back here to sign out. I don't see the cheerfulness that I see when they go out happy, and they're all looking miserable, really, with blisters and everything." And I asked myself the one question, why were you doing out there in the first place? And then before we finished off that conversation, then John brought in the story of Everest having not been attempted by an African, he recalled. So I thought very quickly, where exactly is Mount Everest, by the way? Then I remember that it must be a mountain that is not in Africa. And my immediate response to that was, look, if it is a mountain that is not in my continent, there is no African in his right mind who can actually afford to pay to go to climb a mountain which is overseas, way too far to afford it. And I was thinking about traveling costs, and we didn't know how much it would cost. So when we came to the estimate of what the figure would be, I said, definitely that won't make sense to my mother and my grandmother, who struggles to make ends meet. Why would you want to pay so much money to climb a mountain? John tried to convince me that it is actually a wonderful sport, but very expensive and takes a lot of time and dangerous as well. He did hint that to me.
That's the least of you. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. But then before we finished, John said, hang on, if money wasn't the issue, if you had the time to climb Everest and all that is necessary being the resources, would you do it? So he threw the challenge right on my face like that. And I didn't say to him, well, wait, I'm going to think about this. I will tell you the next time we meet again. At the back of my mind, I saw this could be a great opportunity.
So you seized it.
I seized the opportunity and I said to him, absolutely, I'd love to attempt that mountain if I get the chance to do it. And when I say that, I confess today, I had no idea how high or how tall Mount Everest was.
Did you not?
I'd never seen a picture of Everest. I'd never read a book about Everest. But what made me to say that were two reasons. First, it was I suddenly had the self-belief that I could do it, because John had said to me, my friend, you have the ability to do it as I see you. So I believed in that. And secondly, I had to find a very profound, why would you do it if you got a chance to do it? Because I wasn't suddenly getting excited to go climb mountains. And the why for me was to go and represent my continent and try and tell the world that Africans can do it. Not necessarily on climbing mountains, just anything that they want to achieve. If they commit to it and work very hard, they can do it. And that was the whole motivation to really go.
Because we're talking about those years ago, but we're jumping on, but we'll come back and do it sequentially. But you talk now to many groups of young people, students, people going on expeditions and so on, inspiring them. And you always refer to this as you. Everyone has their own Everest in them.
Yes.
To climb, to achieve.
And, yes.
And this is where it comes from that moment when you said to John, yes, I'll climb Everest, and you didn't even know what it looked like.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, exactly. And after the experience, which for me was life transforming, I realized that life is a mountain. And it will always be there for all of us to climb it. Whether you're sitting not knowing what it is, it will be there waiting for you. So the question is, what is your Everest? What is your mountain?
Sure.
And all mountains are climbed the same way. You've got to want to climb your mountain. You've got to know how high and how big is your mountain. Because before I went, then I knew exactly that Everest was 8,848 meters.
You did actually do a little bit of research.
I did. Absolutely,
yes. So when did that expedition take place?
We talked about it from 1996, but it took us up until about mid-2002. Mm-hmm. By that time, John has returned back into the UK, but we kept contact through letter writing. That's still what we do. We don't email each other. We write letters.
Nice.
I'm sure a lot of people miss that. We write letters and always look at an envelope that's in the post.
And they say,
it's so nice. That's what we do. So John wrote to me mid-2002 and say that, Sibusiso, I recall that once you said one day that if you had the chance to climb Everest, you would do it. There is an opportunity because I found a company that is putting together an expedition to climb Everest next year. And suddenly I thought, next year? Oh, okay, there we go. Again, I didn't say, I need to think about this. I said, if I get the chance to do it next year, I will do it.
Yes.
And that was in 2003. So it had taken us almost 7 years, not necessarily thinking about it or working towards it, but it was at the back of our minds
but
that
sort of
one day it might
growing
happen.
And growing. Yes. So when it came to 2003 and the expedition was going, you joined a bunch of other climbers of different nationalities?
Yes, I joined a bunch of climbers of different nationalities who came from all walks of life, mm-hmm. experience-wise and culturally. But we were so diverse. We had British, we had Americans, we had Norwegians, Canadians. So the diversity made it worth because mm-hmm. it would teach me one thing in life, that it is really not about where you come from. It's not about what school you go to. It's about what is it that you want to do in your life.
Yes.
And all of us were sharing that very common objective or the vision, which was to help each other to reach the summit of Mount Everest.
Mm.
And we were 12 in the team in total, except our support team of Sherpas. So by the time with our team of Sherpas, we must have been about 40 people in the group. And we loved each other. And that was the one thing I took from that, you know, people have the attitude to unite and work together if they believe in what is it that they are uniting to try and achieve. And and that was very profound for me because none of these climbers said to me, you come from Africa. What do you know about climbing mountains coming from Africa? They were very accommodating and they made me feel comfortable. And their experience helped me to gain as much experience when I was with them, which led me to actually reaching the summit of the mountain.
I bet you've kept in touch with a number of those people on that first trip, even to today, because that sort of life-changing thing, as you've described, you know, you can't ever forget, can
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. We have remained very close friends, and we are a family. And with everyone else that I've been on these long expeditions with, we maintain contact. Now, with this ease of social media, we follow each other and we track each other and try and see what everyone else is doing. And I still write to some of them and find out, how can I go about doing something? One of which is a Norwegian polar explorer, polar traveler, who then sold to me the idea of going across Antarctica to the South Pole and the North Pole. When I decided to do that, I contacted him and I said, let me know what I need and how to go about it. And it helped. It was just because of that experience with them on the mountain. And my expeditions have got that way to make people just connect forever.
I'm sure they have. And you, again, were the first Black African person to walk to the South Pole, I think.
Absolutely. Well, it has been absolutely amazing. And I still would like to remind whoever's listening that it all started with that saying, I am Sibusiso, I would be happy to take you on a walk next weekend. Because since then, I realized that I have about 4 firsts under my belt, which would never have happened if I didn't introduce myself to John. I never knew what the opportunities would be. But as they say, opportunities do really appear in very strange disguises. You've got to try and find out what the opportunity will. I became the first Black person in the world to reach the summit of Mount Everest. And when I did it the second time, I'll be the first Black person to do it from both sides successfully on the first attempt.
Oh, you did it from both sides?
Yes.
Your first...
was on the south side.
From the south side, in the more
Buddhism.
Usual route that we can see.
The original, the Edmund Hillary route, successful
and
route.
And the South Col and all that. But the,
then
the
I went on the Tibet side,
Tibet
on the
side.
Northern side.
Which side would you say was more taxing?
I would say the north side will always considered to be technically difficult, But in my view, the north side is much more safer. And people will say, why? Also, because on the north side, you don't have the Khumbu Icefall, which is very dangerous. I mean, it can take your life any time, and you're still lower down the mountain. And secondly, I don't think you cross hundreds of crevices like you would do on the south side, on the north side. And thirdly, you don't have this notorious slab of ice called the Lhotse Face, which is really quite steep and very dangerous, really. You need to be very careful when you are climbing there. So if I took those off, I would say, ideally, the north side is more safer, in my view, but technically hard. If you have got the technical climbing experience and ability, then I would say the north side is your best bet.
Interesting, isn't it? Yes, because you've looked at both sides, John, as well. I'm looking at you now, and you were last in that neck of the woods a year and a half ago.
The money side of it was critical, and then I couldn't get anyone to support him, and then eventually I decided I'd pay for his thing on Everest. But at the last minute, an angel appeared who lived near Taunton, actually, a wonderful man.
An angel in Taunton,
who paid everything. Ah. Doesn't live in Taunton anymore, actually, but a wonderful man. So I got all the money back, so I thought I can go too. And I put myself on a Western Coombe expedition, just going up the ice fall to the Western Coombe. That year I didn't meet Sibusiso at all, because he was higher up the mountain. But then 2 years later, I introduced him to Ranulph Fiennes, and they decided to go together. And it was Sibusiso who inspired Ranulph Fiennes to go to Everest.
Is that right?
As Ran Fiennes records in his book.
I know that you have met and looking at websites and so
but
on.
But it was a similar sort of thing again. Because again, I thought, he's done Everest, thank God, that's done. But then again, he was going with Ran. The money. And again, nobody would support him. I wrote to so many big businesses and things, and I thought, I'll have to just pay. But then, again, an angel appeared, Anglo-American Corporation of South Africa, who had previously not wanted to support him. And they then had second thoughts, and they said, look, we want to take over this whole expedition. We will pay for everything.
Yeah.
So I had my money back. And I was able to go again on a North Col expedition with him.
Yes.
And through an extraordinary circumstances, the people I was climbing with dropped out, the Sherpas who were with them and me had to go back with somebody who was ill. But I was with Sibusiso at the foot of the very steep, icy climb up to the North Col. And of course, I should have gone back with my Sherpas, but I didn't want to have come so far without doing it. So I said, Sibusiso, do you know your way up here? He said, I've already been up twice acclimatizing here. And I said, right, let's go up together. So we were climbing completely alone on the north side of Everest. And that was a wonderful experience.
Oh, wow. And what height?
And again, he saved my life there, actually, because I was stupidly dropped a glove at one stage and unclipped from the rope to go and fetch the glove. And he shouted at me, no, don't do that. For goodness sake, clip on again.
You tell him to be gone.
But that was a wonderful experience.
Oh, that must have been stunning. On your own, in
it was very special area. Because we had never been on such a big mountain, and you asked how what was the altitude. We climbed to as high as just below 7,000 meters together.
That's about 23,000 feet.
About.
I can only work in feet in that high.
Absolutely,
that's high. Were you using oxygen at that point?
Not at all. No, no. That part of the climb or the altitude, you still do without oxygen. You start using oxygen from about 8,000 meters.
Have you ever suffered from mountain sickness? Has it ever affected you? I'm looking at both of you, actually, but Sibusiso.
Not for me. I wouldn't say the severity of it. The two killer ones being pulmonary edema and cerebral edema, I never suffered those. But all the other symptoms, headaches, nausea, and feeling tired, those you get. And my biggest, which I still haven't overcome in the many expeditions or climbs I've done in my life, is sleep deprivation. Once I get over 4,000 meters, I don't sleep that well. But it doesn't really frustrate me because I know it happens to me and there's no way I can counter that.
Really?
I've accepted it.
I've always thought that the cold kind of induces sleep. You know, you'd expect you to feel quite tired. Actually,
it varies from one person to another, I've noticed, because there are people that will be at 6,000, 7,000 meters, and within half an hour, they're just...
They're out of
fast,
it.
They're out the fast asleep, and there you are, staring, whiling away the night by the hour, and you're like, what is happening? So it happened, it varies from one person to another, and unfortunately, it does lead to other people getting up very grumpy the next morning, and they just want to go home, because some people really love their sleep. I love my sleep, but if I don't get it on a mountain, I say, it will not stop me.
You can
It won't stop me from... From climbing up, not at all.
Because the climbs that you've done, again, looking through websites, are absolutely amazing. There are so many climbs and expeditions, like the South Pole one, with a group of South African...
Yes, when we did that, it was again an idea that you get, because all of the expeditions I've done, it's just a matter of being talked into doing them. And I've never sat down and thought, what do I do next? And it's just opening my ears and listening to people. A South African man who climbs as well, Alex Harris, climbed with Ronald Fiennes and myself in 2005. And we were sitting, thinking about what else are we doing. I was now in the process of trying to climb the seven summits, the remaining mountains that made up the seven summits. So Alex said to me, so I've always thought about the South Pole expedition. And I said, that's something I would like to do as well. So we went back to South Africa and decided that we will organize and execute South Africa's first unsupported and unassisted expedition from the coast of Antarctica to the South Pole.
Gosh.
Two people that were doing it, myself and Alex Harris, who spent 65 days covering a distance of about 1,100 kilometers.
Unsupported,
and carrying pretty much everything. And the one inspiring side of it was we both came from different backgrounds. I am a black South African, he's a white South African. And many years ago, that collaboration will never happen.
No.
But we did it, and we executed the expedition, and we succeeded, and we became the only, up until today, the only first South Africans to mount such an expedition and succeed in achieving it.
And what that says politically as well, to not just South Africa, but the whole world, is absolutely fantastic, isn't it?
It is.
The
it
unity
is
absolutely
yes.
The struggle.
Absolutely, it does. It does say to us, you know what? We are very similar. We are the same, and we have got the right mindset to work together if we choose to, and we can succeed. And that is the only way, I believe, even in governments anywhere in the world, the only way we can hope to succeed in achieving or counteracting all the challenges we face, either economically or socially, is by working together.
Yes.
And that can be done.
How right you are. I wish there was more of it, don't we all?
Oh, we do. We do hope. But if we say it, if we tell people, if people are able to look at examples like my example and Alex Harris, and my example with all the other people that I've been on expeditions with, who never knew who I was, but they never asked me, where do you come from? What can you tell us about climbing mountains or anything? We just worked together, and that those sort of collaborations are what is needed in the world today.
Tell us about your meeting with Nelson Mandela. That must have been a lovely, lovely occasion.
It was very special. For me, it was very humbling to meet him, because by strange reasons, in the game reserve where I was working as a guide, he had stayed as soon as he walked out of prison. I think he tried to stay at very remote places just to sort of have his
recover.
Time. And he had stayed at the reserve where I worked, but unfortunately I wasn't a game ranger there. So all the guests that came to reserve, because that's what everyone else does now nowadays, Mandela stayed here and all of it, it's all in their brochure and everything, they would ask me, were you here? Did you ever meet him? And I always said, I never met him, but he's the one person that I would like to meet in my life. And I never knew how that was going to happen, because I realized that he was getting older. So immediately I come from Everest, I got the surprise call that I would be meeting him the next day.
Oh, goodness.
And I thought, no, it is this thing they call April Fool. It's not April Fool's Day. It is in June now. Surely this must be something true. And I never believed it up until until such time that I found myself at his place in his office, and I saw him walk towards me and the journalists that were there, because he had to address the media people that were there. And Mandela has this amazing thing to make you feel comfortable with him, and he never made you feel that you're meeting a very important global icon. He says, as he walks out, he says, it is wonderful, Sibusiso, to come and visit me, but it always makes me wonder why young people want to see me, because people say I have lost power, I have lost position, I am a has-been. Why would you want to come and see a person like that? So, and I said, Mandela, we all love you, we all want to see you, actually. But he was just saying to me, don't even think that I'm Mandela. I'm like you. Then he addressed the media and said, "Well, we are very proud of what you have achieved, and for me, it does send a message to the world and to Africans themselves that not the Western world can actually try and attempt the near impossible and triumph. Africans can do it as well." He said, "Your message is very clear to young people in Africa, and I hope that some of them can step up and follow in your footsteps and achieve what you've achieved." So that was quite humbling.
Very humbling.
And he challenged me, and when he said, "I have set a standard for the continent," said by saying, "You know, what you have done, you need to keep it. You need to keep going. You need to improve on it, because you're now being looked upon as a role model, as a symbol of success."
Well, I was just about to say this, Sibusiso, because you are representing Africa in many people's minds now, and the accolades that have come to you, quite rightly, are hopefully representative of many more, hopefully, young people coming up and struggling to achieve what their Everests are.
Absolutely.
Because I loved the fact, reading the websites, that you're now the chief scout of South Africa, which is a lovely thing, because the scout movement is a great grouping, isn't it?
It is a wonderful youth movement, which has got life values that are actually very influential and impactful to anybody, because all the people that I meet who are at over 50, over 60 years old, they say, "I've been living my life through the values I learned when I was a scout."
Exactly.
And that's why you realize that it is a movement that has got such potential to make the leaders that we want to lead our country forward, or our world forward, as we know, we all believe that the future of any community or any society or any country is in its youth. And I believe that the Scouts movement is the only movement that can do that and achieve that for all communities.
Is it strong as a movement in South Africa?
It was strong for many, many years, but it was predominantly Afrikaans, white dominated, but now it has changed. That's why then cleverly they brought me in as a young person who's very adventurous, who every young person can sort of relate to, because that's how you become a role model.
So you're an ambassador for the Scouts.
I am. I'm the face.
You're saying it can be done.
Yes, I'm the face of Scouts in South Africa, to say it's a wonderful movement, and it's really something that every young kid should be joining and becoming a member of, because there's a lot that you learn. And the one thing I love about scouting is you learn by doing, practically. And they learn skills that they otherwise wouldn't learn at home sitting and playing those computer games.
No, very much not.
No,
that's a whole different discussion.
Exactly.
Yes, but now you're here in the UK for just a six-day trip, and it's pretty jam-packed, because you've already given a couple of your inspirational presentations, which now you do a lot of traveling around talking to every group, but ideally I suspect you like talking to young people.
I love talking to young people, because I solely believe that they are the only ones that needs to be nurtured and given hope, because the majority of them are sort of lost, and they're thinking that life is no longer worth living. But you say to them, "Look, life is still worth living as long as you have aims. You need to set your own personal goals. What is it that you want to be, do, and have in your life?" And then you work hard toward achieving that, because I think there is this misleading phenomenon that everything has to happen in a silver platter, as they put it. But it does. Well, life, unfortunately, doesn't work like that. You've got to earn it, and you earn it the hard way. So I love to speak to young people, and I can only say thanks. Thank you very much to John again, who realized that there's an opportune time here that I would be here. Then why not try and do something? And he got all these talks happening. But the reason I'm here is because I'm going to be joining an invitation to celebrate in a party that celebrates the achievement of a charity that has been going since 2005, where a wonderful lady and lost her son under some very incurable diseases. And sadly, she felt that I wanted to do something in memory of my boy named Lawrence. And she found that in South Africa, there was this thing where kids play. It's called the roundabout, and they think they're playing, yet they're pumping water into a tank.
But at the same time,
and yes. Which is really wonderful, particularly coming from the Southern African region. I know how difficult it is to get water, particularly at schools and everything. And John very kindly donated to this charity, and last year we went to open one of these play roundabouts in a place not far from where I live in Nelspruit, near the Kruger National Park, in the Bushbuck Ridge, and hence my being invited to be part of the celebration. But it is just saying that, well, through the memory of a young kid, if you donated, you could be saving lives
and bringing
and
water
changing
to villages.
Many children, exactly,
yes,
villages.
Yes. What a lovely, simple, absolutely. It's a simple idea. The simple ideas
it
are often
is.
The best ones, aren't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. One is really very grateful for them to invite me to come over here. So it has been one of the most best visits, apart from the ones that John and I had very briefly go and climb a mountain or something, to be able to come and share my journey to where I am today, coming from my background, where when I was up until the age of 10, I would be walking
you
barefooted.
You could never have envisaged this journey.
Exactly, and most people that would have seen me then, they would have said, shame what a poor boy, it will amount to nothing. But all the efforts and support from people and appreciating opportunities that falls into one's hands and taking them.
Now, am I right that tonight you're going to the House of Lords?
Yes.
That's fairly huge.
I'm looking forward to that again, to celebrate this boy's life in that way. They have achieved so much. I mean, I think the celebration is in recognition of their £1 million in fundraising, which is really never easy, but it takes commitment and passion and dedication to achieve that. So we really are looking
That'll
forward.
That'll be fascinating.
And I will also speak there talking about living in water scarcity area.
Well, that'll be very useful as well as inspirational, because there are a lot of people there who have many, many areas of influence. And who knows what may come back from that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that will be fantastic.
Oh, yeah, we hope if they are able to listen to me and then obviously act on Mandela's words again, where he encouraged us to say that it is in our hands to create the world, a better world for all to live in it. And I think this is what we need to do, all of us.
Yes. And then before you whiz home, you're speaking at Eton, I think.
Yes,
John
has all the itinerary of where you're speaking next.
you're his road manager.
The only thing he says, because John does not believe that little gadget called memory sticks works. Only the one thing, if we get onto the car, he says, have you got your memory stick yet?
Yes.
And then he says, well, it worked very well last night or yesterday. We hope it works today. But
I know. I have a similar paranoia, because until it works, it's not working.
Not at all.
No, but I'm sure that if anywhere, they can sort it
out. I'm looking forward to the talk at Eton College
again,
for the fact that Ronald Fiennes went there, John went there, and there are many people that I know have been to that. So I'm excited to go and share my own experiences.
And again, those people will go on to be the leaders in this country and elsewhere, and
absolutely,
they will have influence and thoughts. It can only be like the pebble with the ripples going out, you know, your influence is influencing others.
Absolutely, exactly. Looking forward to that.
Yes. Well, what a busy trip it's been. It's a total pleasure that we've managed to grab a little half an hour with you. It's been a real pleasure speaking to CBC.
Oh, we thank you very much, and we thank the listeners as well, and we really appreciate the opportunity to talk to us. Thank you.
Well, it's lovely to meet you. And John, thank you so much for suggesting this interview to me way back. And it's lovely to, because we've spoken about your meeting before, but it's lovely to now actually meet Supersisu and so know that we can actually, you know, we're putting faces to names. It's just great. Have a very successful remainder of your trip and all the other inspirational things you're doing, you know.
Thank you.
All success.
Wonderful.
Thank you very much. Now then, John, you asked for some music, which of course is almost the only thing that we can play at the end of our conversation, the South African National Anthem, which is just lovely, and it tears you apart, doesn't it? It does me anyway, and I'm sure you. So that's what we're going to hear at the end of our conversation. Thank you both.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you.
Why you meet us?